From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Saratoga.
Presidio.
San Francisco, California. Excelsior District, District 11.
Montaloma School District, Mountain View, California.
The city of Richmond is voting for a new mayor. What are we learning from the debates taking place between the three candidates?
They can't ask no questions. All you do is write down your comments, and they're going to pick the questions that they want to answer.
Then we'll learn about some local flying dinosaurs.
If you're a human being at all, you start to feel close to this fellow being.
And we'll tell you the story behind this week's Audiograph Mystery Sound. We're having a few laughs today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. The city of Richmond is home to about 100,000 people, and it's a study in contrasts. For one thing, there's the oil refinery run by Chevron, the 18th largest company in the world. Then there's the city's leadership. Mayor Gail McLaughlin represents the Green Party. Under the Richmond Progressive Alliance, the city adopted the highest minimum wage in California and created an ambitious plan to rescue underwater mortgages. Richmond has an extraordinary blend of business and social interests, but the balance could change dramatically on November 4th when a new mayor is elected. Over the last 2 months, KALW's Todd Whitney has been following the mayoral campaigns and attended the debates. Here's his report.
About 100 people are here at Richmond City Hall for a debate sponsored by the League of Women Voters. It's an overflow crowd, and there are so many folks here that some of them have to watch all the action on flat screens around the council chambers. And while the audience is packed in, the chairs where the council members usually sit are mostly empty. There's only three individuals there, Nat Bates, Tom Butt, and Uche Wahemu, and one of them will be Richmond's next mayor. It's a small field compared to the 15 people running in Oakland, but there's still a lot riding on this election, and that's drawn some young folks out today.
My name is Jordan Mason. I am 16 years old. I like Uche. I like how his beliefs are and how he supports local communities. Go Uche.
No, he's not quite able to vote for Uche Wahemu just yet. But some of his older peers are. And they're not just voting. Many Richmond youth are volunteering to work on Wahemu's campaign. And he's playing up that fresh take on politics to separate himself from Bates and Butt, both of whom are currently serving on the city council.
Let me make this very clear. They have had their chance to lead this community. They have failed. In November, we have a good opportunity here to begin a change in Richmond.
Richmond has one of the highest unemployment rates in the Bay Area, at 9.9%. Part of Wahemu's plan to improve is to create a tech hub and an incubator that teaches Richmond's youth computer skills.
But one of the things we have to pay attention is, one, we have over 35% unemployment among our youth. So how do we deal with that?
While Wahemu is focusing on building up the youth, Nat Bates is banking on his experience. He's been involved in Richmond politics since 1967, and he intends to solve the unemployment problem by attracting businesses to Richmond.
You have to create a friendly business climate, of which this city does not have.
Bates wants to make it easier and faster for businesses to move into Richmond by consolidating the permit process. It's what he calls a one-stop shop.
You've got to create a climate where businesses want to come to your city.
The biggest business in Richmond is also a big Bates supporter, Chevron. And the company spent some $3 million on the local election. And then there's Tom Butt, who's worked in City Hall for nearly 20 years. He has the endorsement of the Richmond Progressive Alliance. That's current Mayor Gail McLaughlin's party. And some are looking to Butt to continue her progressive legacy, but he's mostly avoided that rhetoric in his campaign.
What we've focused on, and I think what is most important, is improving the quality of life in Richmond. If we do that, businesses want to come here, particularly small businesses.
Butt's an architect, and he views infrastructure and public safety as the keys to a successful Richmond. He calls it nuts and bolts. And he points to examples of growth as reasons to stay on the same track. One of those victories is drawing an extension of the Lawrence Berkeley Lab to Richmond.
Richmond is not a city that needs to be fixed. We had a lot of problems that need to be addressed. But I want to tell you, we're making huge improvements in the quality of life in Richmond. We just need to keep going and do more and do it better.
At the debate, the three candidates spoke mostly in political platitudes and generalities. And that lack of depth in responses and pushback by moderators, it frustrated many attendees like Mark Wasberg.
They cannot ask no questions. All you do is fill out some stupid, write down your comments, and they're going to pick the questions that they want to answer.
So Richmond voters will have to do the best they can with the information that they've got. And it's important, of course, in a city of contrast like Richmond, where oil interests have competed against a green mayor for the past 8 years, the next mayor will eventually have to face a lot of tough questions. In Richmond, I'm Todd Whitney for Cross Currents.
What do you think the city of Richmond needs? What's working there and what isn't? Leave your ideas on our feedback line. It's 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106, and we may get your call on the air. Documentary filmmaker Judy Irving's movie, The Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill, was a love letter to San Francisco and some of its most colorful residents. Now Irving has turned her camera toward another local bird, the California brown pelican.
A wonderful bird is the pelican. His bill will hold more than his belly can. He can take in his beak food enough for a week, but I'm damned if I see how the hell he can.
Those are the words of Dixon Lanier Merritt, and they're part of Judy Irving's new film, Pelican Dreams. Its world premiere is tomorrow night at 3 Bay Area theaters. The celebrated documentarian joined KALW's Ben Trefney in studio to talk about her latest work.
So I'd like to begin at the beginning of Pelican Dreams. And at the beginning, there's a pelican on the Golden Gate Bridge. Could you set us up there?
Yeah, well, I had been wanting to make a movie about pelicans for a really long time, even before The Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill, because I've loved them since I was a kid, but I didn't know anything about them, right? So then this bird handed me a narrative arc by landing by mistake on the Golden Gate Bridge, creating a huge traffic jam on a Sunday afternoon, getting herself arrested, taken away in a police car, and I decided, hey, I'm going to follow that bird and see where it takes me. So that's the beginning of the movie.
And how and when did you get involved with that story?
Gigi, I named her Gigi for Golden Gate.
The pelican.
The pelican landed on the bridge way at the beginning of this production period, which was 6 years ago. And a friend of mine was in the traffic jam, sent me an email and said, you'll never guess why I was held up on the Golden Gate Bridge today. There was a pelican in the roadway. And so Mark Bittner, the star of Parrots, who's now my husband, is really good on the internet. So he went on looking around, and in about a day, a YouTube video showed up of the whole thing.
Oh, it's injured, I think.
Was this on YouTube?
Of the arrest of Gigi and the cop car and everything. So we got in touch with the folks who shot that. They were riding their bikes across Golden Gate Bridge, and we got permission to use it in the movie.
Oh, he got arrested.
So that's the opening credits sequence. It's really funny.
And you went to the Channel Islands.
Yes.
Where a lot of the California brown pelicans come from.
Right. So I found out that brown pelicans breed in Baja in Mexico on these islands and in the Channel Islands off of Southern California. And not knowing where Gigi came from, I decided that she must have come from the Channel Islands because I didn't have the money to go to Baja at the time. So I went to the Channel Islands and built up a visual story of what her life might have been like as a young bird.
So we have a clip that I'm going to play here and talk about it a little bit. So here you are in the Channel Islands. It's uninhabited by people, at least the part that you're at there. Is it completely uninhabited?
Yes. Santa Barbara Island is a very remote island, 42 miles off the coast of Southern California.
And it's hilly and rocky and kind of scrub brushy?
It's hilly and it's small, and it's a good place for pelicans to nest because there are not any big mammal predators on the island. And no one actually lives there full time.
So you're there, and you're filming young pelicans, and here's what you say as you're narrating the documentary.
The surviving chicks are about 2.5 months old when they get together at the top of the hill in a juvenile gang and start to figure out what their bodies are actually built for.
And then they're on this slope, and there's one that's on the slope, and there's no humans around. And one's about to take a leap, and here's how your narration continues.
What does it feel like to fly for the first time? How scary is it? How does it feel after being earthbound all your life when you're finally in your element?
And we see a pelican flying for the first time. And it's kind of like, it looks like a person running down a slope with a hang glider, but the hang glider is part of their body. This is pretty much what it looks like to me. And so then you kind of start to muse. And I'm wondering, what does flying, the idea of flying, mean to you?
Well, when I was a kid, I used to have flying dreams. And I loved those dreams. I would be at bird height, you know, just a little bit above the treetops. And I could soar along. I didn't have to flap my wings. And I could look down at everything. I don't know where those were coming from, but they went away as I got older. And so these pelicans, I love the way they fly. They soar. They seem effortless. And I was wondering, as I watched these young birds get older and start to flap those huge wings, what is it like to fly for the first time? Especially if you're a big bird like that, 8 to 10 pounds, you've spent your entire life on land, and now you have to take this leap. How scary is it? What does it feel like?
That's documentary filmmaker Judy Irving talking about her latest movie, Pelican Dreams. So in the course of your filming, you met another pelican. There was Gigi, who was on the Golden Gate Bridge, and then you met Moro, named after Moro Bay. And I'd like you to tell us a little bit about Moro.
Moro is a backyard bird who lives with chickens and a duck and geese in the home of Danny and Bill Nicholson in Cayucos, which is near Moro Bay on the Central California coast. And Moro had a wing injury. He came in originally with two other birds, so they had three pelicans waddling around their yard. And Danny Nicholson is a wildlife rehabilitator, so she has a license, and she does long-term care in her yard. She gets birds from the local wildlife hospital if something's going to take a really long time to heal. So that's how Moro came to see her.
So they're trying to find a place for Moro, ultimately, someplace that Moro can live permanently, even though, you know, Moro's got a pretty decent existence for a flightless bird in this large backyard with other animals. But as the movie progresses, eventually no other pelicans, and that could be a little bit difficult. Then something unexpected happens, and we're going to play a little clip where you introduce this unexpected thing.
There was one place he could go, though, that he hadn't explored yet.
And the place that he could go that he hadn't explored yet is their house. And one day you were filming inside the house and Moro walked in. Can you describe what's happening here?
Oh, I don't know if I want to give this one away, but okay. Special to KALW. I love this sequence. It shows Moro at his most curious, his most intelligent. You can see the fear and the trepidation, but also the curiosity that he has about the house. This is a pelican. He's never had a roof over his head, let alone ever seen an overstuffed chair or a couch or a lamp or a lampshade, you know, or the fire burning in the stove. So This is a pretty special sequence, and you have to see it. I'm not going to say anything else about it.
Then we hear Bill Nicholson talk about what Morrow means to him.
This one particular pelican I have a personal relationship with, as does my wife. And it does grow over time. And the thought of him leaving our home actually creates a sadness in me.
What do you think of this idea that he's touching on there of developing relationships with rehabilitating wild animals?
Well, one of the things that wildlife rehabilitators always try to adhere to is they try to keep a distance from the animal that they're rehabilitating because the animal is meant to go back to the wild. And it's better for the wild animal if they are not friendly with people. If they're shy of people, that's better. They'll get into less trouble when they go out. But also, you know, after a few years, you watch the bird, you get kind of close to the bird, you learn about the bird's personality, and if you're a human being at all, you start to feel close to this fellow being. And that's what Bill is talking about. If the animal has an injury that isn't going to heal, and if the animal can't be released to the wild, then you could blur the line just a little bit, because the bird is going to have to adapt
to a human world,
to a changed world. But if the bird has a chance, or the animal has a chance of being released back to where that creature is most comfortable, it really makes sense to keep a distance.
That's documentary filmmaker Judy Irving speaking with KALW's Ben Trefney. Irving's latest movie, Pelican Dreams, premieres in theaters in Berkeley, San Rafael, and San Francisco tomorrow night. Find more information about the movie and her local appearances at KALW.org. Click on Cross Currents. It's also where you can find a web exclusive where Irving gives a behind-the-scenes discussion of what it takes to make a nature documentary.
All the footage in the Channel Islands was filmed on 16mm. The HD color, to my eye, isn't as rich or thick or deep or whatever you want to call it. Not that I would go back to schlepping around 40-pound cases and 26-pound NPR eclairs and all of that. I really love the lightweight quality of HD and beyond, and I'll stick with it, you know, but I do miss that about film.
Judy Irving on filmmaking, online at KALW.org. Now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's Audiograph's Julie Kane to bring you the answer to this week's mystery sound.
All week long, we've been playing you this sound.
Okay, come here.
Was that a giggle?
Yes. I wonder how often people hear them giggle at zoos.
Hi, Guy.
Hi. It's okay. He's a little shy. Oh, listen.
We asked you what that was and where you think we recorded it. To bring us the answer, we visited a research station just behind the UC Berkeley campus. At one time, it was home to 43 spotted hyenas. Now, only 4 remain, and not for much longer. Funding has run out, and by the end of this month, the last 4 will be resettled in wildlife retirement homes in Southern California and Texas. We sent KALW's Mary Reese to find out more about these unusual animals.
And you can come on in. Hi, Dusty. You're going to be quiet, huh? My name is Mary Weldley,
And I'm a research specialist at UC Berkeley in the psych department, and I've been the colony manager of the spotted hyenas here.
Hi, Guy. Hi. It's okay.
He's a little shy. Oh, listen.
Was that a giggle?
Yes. So you can imagine hearing that on the fire trail in the evening, maybe, or early morning, and it's like, what is that? I'm still waiting for a whoop. Please whoop.
Can you imitate it?
Oh, God. I can do a slow whoop. It's whoop, whoop. And the thing about it, when they're whooping, their heads are pointed to the ground. They don't, it's not like a coyote or a wolf. They stand up and their nose is usually just inch off the ground. It's really, you can feel it in your shoes sometimes if you're standing up here on the cement.
My name is Frederick Tunison, and I'm a professor in the psychology department at Berkeley. I was, you know, interested in animal communication. And studying songbirds and communication in birds in general. And when I got the job at UC Berkeley, I found out that there was a colony of spotted hyenas. And it turns out that this is one of the terrestrial mammals with one of the most complex vocal repertoires. The giggle, right, which is the hyena laugh, is probably the one that's most known. And it's produced in situations where there's some amount of social tension. So it's not a ha-ha, I'm having a good time. It's more like I'm not really getting what I want, and there's a social situation where I want to be part of. And the animals that are more dominant have a more steady giggle. And it's more like, you know, I imagine more like the
evil villain.
Yeah,
so.
Evil villain, exactly.
When they were producing The Lion King, they sent the people who were working on the lions to Africa, and the people who were supposed to be sketching the hyenas came here.
What do you think, Ed? Just what I was thinking.
We had some hyenas that had their canines blunted because it was recommended by some veterinary dentist, and we forgot to tell them. And so the canines of the hyenas in The Lion King are blunter than they would be. I don't know what your opinion was of hyenas before you came here, but one of our goals has been to show people what wonderful animals they are, and they're worth conserving. Hey, come here, Cass.
Hello.
Hello. Yeah, they're really sweet. You know, they all have their own personality, and they have great memories. If you hand rear a hyena, that hyena is your friend for life.
Friends for life. Our winner this week is Simon Lang. Congratulations, Simon. We're going to send you a KALW t-shirt. For the rest of you, here's a sneak listen to next week's mystery sound.
So what we'll do is we'll start recording, we'll ask a question, we'll wait 10 seconds, see if we got anything. So here we go, I'll start recording in 3, 2, 1. Is there anyone in here that'd like to speak with us today?
Ooh, think you know what that is and where we recorded it? Give us a call at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. We'll tell you the story behind the sound next Thursday on Cross Currents. To find out more, head to our website, kalw.org. Click on Audiograph. Thanks for listening, and thanks for playing. I'm Julie Kane.
And that's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Sandhya Dirks, Rachel Dornhelm, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Colin Peden, Seth Samuel, Raja Shah, Stephen Short, and Todd Whitney. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Nina Gensler-Debs. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And you are a big part of our show, and we love hearing from you. So email us at news@kalw.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW. Because of you, we can proudly say we are listener-supported public radio. This is Paige and the Thousand. They'll be performing this Sunday at the bottom of the hill in their hometown of San Francisco. Doors open at 7:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
I try to hide it, but it makes itself known. You'll dig it.